This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, the artist Klaus Oldenburg, once said, "I am for art that embroils itself in everyday crap and still comes out on top." Oldenburg and his wife and partner Kosha van Bruggen have designed a series of colossal public sculptures in the shapes of everyday objects. Cleveland has their giant rubber stamp. Miami has their fruit bowl. Chicago, a giant baseball bat. Las Vegas has a flashlight. Their monuments have always been controversial, but as art critic Robert Hughes once wrote, no living artist combines the roles of magician and clown with as much skill as Oldenburg. His achievement has been to take an extraordinary range of banal objects and invest them with consistent metaphoric power. Oldenburg was born in Sweden but grew up in Chicago. Now Rizzoli has published a retrospective catalog of Oldenburg's multiples. One of Oldenburg's sculptures, a 45-foot-high clothespin, is across the street from City Hall in Philadelphia, where I live. It's easily my favorite public sculpture in the city. On even the most humdrum day, it brings wit and design into your life.
What you're experiencing, I think, would be one of the things that Kosha and I would be hoping for, is that it would do something in the landscape that would be different, would be surprising, it's not always humorous, but I mean, there's an element there, sometimes of the unexpected, which can be humorous. And the clothespin is an example of a sculpture that is quite formal. Some of the things we've done since then have been freer, but this one is very formal and very much like the structures in the city. So it's a kind of variation on a skyscraper. And its origin really goes back to a variation on a skyscraper in Chicago. That was a famous competition in 1922 for a design for the Tribune, Chicago Tribune Tower. And when the first drawing of the clothespin was made in 1967, it was made as a late submission to that competition. In other words, a variation, a kind of Gothic variation, of the building that won the competition, which is, as you all know, a Gothic structure.
Although you've been doing these sculptures for years, they've never ceased becoming controversial. For instance, you designed a rubber stamp, and this was a commission for the Standard Oil headquarters in Cleveland. It was commissioned in 1985, but then British Petroleum bought Standard Oil, and they rejected the completed sculpture. Why did they reject it?
Well, they've never said exactly why they rejected it, but it probably had something to do with the fact that they didn't want to appear to be what they called a rubber stamp of the company they'd taken over. I suppose this there's something about the name rubber stamp which has a negative connotation, though that's not the way that Kosha and I see it. We see it as a normal, humble office object, just like a clothespin that can be subject for a sculpture. However, this particular stamp wasn't really known as the rubber stamp. It was known as the free stamp, and that's because on the stamp it said free. That was the concept from the beginning. So it had it went a little bit beyond the idea of enlarging a rubber stamp.
Do you think it violates the rules when a company buys another company and reneges on their commitment to buy the sculpture?
Well, it violates a contract we had, and of course that leaves us with very little option since we couldn't sue the company. But by a long process of citizen action, really, the sculpture came back as a sculpture for the city of Cleveland. And now it's no longer in front of a private building. It's next to the city hall, so it has a more universal application. So we feel that the end result of this 9-year process was really positive, after all, and that the piece as it's now installed, which is on its side rather than standing up, is what was the destiny for the piece all along.
How tall is the rubber stamp now?
The free stamp.
The free stamp, yes.
Well, the free stamp is about 60 feet long. At this point, since it's lying on its side,
right,
we won't speak of it standing up. It rises from the ground about 25 feet, and then it lies about 60 feet.
You know, when when it became a city monument instead of a corporate monument, it still got some angry reactions. I was reading some of the press coverage in Cleveland, and some of the columnists are saying, you know, what kind of art is this? Why do you think people get upset when an ordinary object is used as the subject of art?
Well, I don't know if that's what upsets people, but of course the tradition in public sculpture is to create something hierarchical, which is up on a pedestal, and people are perhaps surprised when that tradition is turned on its head, and you get instead a very simple object that most people probably don't feel belongs on a pedestal. But in modern times, it seems that such an object is more appropriate than, say, an equestrian statue. But people get angry for many reasons, and very often a public sculpture, because of its because it gets a lot of attention, is used by people to promote their own causes. And politicians will use it to make a case of some sort, which will call attention to themselves. I think it's very good that that people do discuss and raise controversies over sculptures. Kosha and I feel that it wouldn't be right somehow to put up something that everybody would agree on, that we have a responsibility as artists to practice the same approach that we do in private, which is to say to create something that has a bit of an edge, that lies a little bit ahead of general consciousness, or try to do that. So when that's transferred into public art, it does make people sometimes surprised, though they do get used to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about the controversy surrounding one other city sculpture that you did, and this was one for the city of Miami. It was called Drop Bowl with Scattered Slices and Peels. Let me ask you to describe it.
Well, the concept was of a bowl dropped into a plaza, a giant bowl, very large bowl, which contained slices of oranges and peels of oranges and some kind of a liquid, which wasn't exactly defined, that became the fountain element, the water element.
Mm-hmm.
And the bowl hit the plaza and scattered into seven pieces and seven fragments, and then the insides, what was inside, went flying out too. And this was all realized almost like a snapshot or a still moment of movement. And then it was realized in concrete and plastic and metal, and the water element was introduced. So what this was really was a translation of the traditional idea of a fountain, which usually has some kind of a bowl and figures in it, and it was taking that notion and sort of shattering it. This was Kosh's reaction to the situation there, which was a very formal situation that was forced on us. She said, well, why don't we just break the bowl and scatter the pieces? And that way the sculpture was less monolithic and it could take in a lot more space.
Now, part of the controversy around this particular piece was over the safety aspects of it. One person cut his leg after falling into one of the pools that catches the water from the fountain. Then a disabled rights group said that all the kind of jagged edges, or all the edges, I should say, created a hazard for the blind. What was your reaction to that, and did you take those kinds of safety considerations into account when designing it?
Well, we met with various groups after the sculpture was put up, and we agreed on certain precautions.
Mm-hmm.
There are some buttons marking the edges of the sculpture and other warning systems, so that issue is settled. I feel that in any public sculpture will be as dangerous as it is just to move around in the city. I know if you just I was just on the street here in New York, and for 1 minute I didn't concentrate, and I nearly got clipped by a taxi. So I think that awareness like that is something you bring to your appreciation of a sculpture in the middle of the city. But, of course, there are special considerations for people who are handicapped and people who are blind. And we meet these considerations and discuss them and then do what we can.
So what's the status of that piece now? It's still up.
Well, that piece it was closed briefly while they put in the safeguards, and mm-hmm. now it's been opened again. And I haven't seen it for a few months, but I get reports that it's in operating condition.
Is there much graffiti on any of Republic sculpture? And I'm wondering if there is, how you feel about it, given your love of the kind of vitality of the city and everyday objects. You could make an argument that graffiti fits right into that.
Well, I think you could, but it really does interfere with the intentions of the sculpture. And it varies a great deal. It depends on the location and how much care is taken to keep the sculpture up. Of course, a public sculpture is a very prominent location, and for people who want to call attention to themselves, it's the best place to write. So it often does happen, but in most of the locations, there is attention to this detail. We were just in Barcelona, where we put up a large sculpture in the Olympics program, and there they are going to a lot of trouble to keep it painted. But I say it depends on the situation and the place.
Which sculpture has had the most graffiti?
Well, we have one that has reached a point of graffiti coverage where it has almost ceased to be a sculpture, and that's in Münster, Germany, where we created the pool balls, which are three concrete balls in a park in the middle of the city. And from the very beginning, these balls were used as bulletin boards, kind of, for the expression of personal and political feelings and posters and whatever. And we tried to scrape them down, but after a while we realized if we kept scraping, there'd be no sculpture left. So then we tried painting, but that didn't seem to do much good. So after a while, we just left it alone. And we look at them now as spherical billboards and have publicly disowned them as sculptures.
I'm interested in the roots of how you started doing these oversized, now colossal sculptures of ordinary objects. You started doing this kind of work in much smaller versions, I believe it was in the early 1960s. What was on your mind then that led you in that direction?
Well, the first large-scale work was in 1969, which was the lipstick for Yale University. Before that, I'd been doing fantastic drawings of real sites, such as the clothespin I mentioned, where they were called proposed colossal monuments. Another one was the Good Humor Bar as a substitute for the Pan Am building on Park Avenue. And there were many situations like that that were proposed where the existing building had something in common with something much smaller. Like Pan Am definitely has the shape of a Good Humor Bar, and the substitution was made in the media of drawing and as convincingly as possible. But in 69, these drawings were well known to the students of architecture at Yale University. And when Herbert Marcuse, the socialist philosopher, came to lecture, they purposely asked him what would happen to society if some of these structures were built. And Marcuse replied that if that happened, then capitalist society would be at an end. So this stimulated the students to commission a sculpture on a large scale, a real version of these fantastic proposals. And so I got the commission to do a sculpture for the center of Yale University. And this was, of course, all done surreptitiously, and the authorities weren't asked. So the sculpture was prepared in secret and brought into Beinecke Plaza, which is the war memorial at the center of the university. And this was in the late 60s, and the mood, of course, was very combative, and the students were very involved. And it was a very exciting moment, and the authorities sort of decided to let it happen because they thought if they stepped in and prevented it, much worse things could occur. So the sculpture did get put up, and that was the first large-scale project.
My guest is sculptor Klaus Oldenburg. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Artist Klaus Oldenburg is my guest. What is it about ordinary objects that you take such pleasure in?
Well, I've always been very interested in deriving my art from my surroundings, from my daily experiences. And so my daily experiences are not very adventurous or dramatic. They tend to revolve around very simple things, just as most people's. And there came a moment when I saw these things as potential sculptures, razor blades, toothbrushes, soaps, whatever. I thought they have a certain character and identity and formal quality in themselves, which could be used as sculpture. And this was something which just came naturally. It also is important to me that I can touch all these things in a small scale, and I can feel the object completely, say, in a small scale, before I proceed to making a large version of it. So it has very personal origins, which later became involved with the general practices of pop art and so on. But this interest in smaller objects had a personal origin.
Were you ever interested in a more classical, traditional art?
Well, I'm still interested in classical, traditional art, and the kind of art that I've done very often makes references to traditional art and tries to establish links with it. A large raisin bread, for example, has something in it of David's painting of Madame Récamier, things like that. There are allusions and references which try to connect the present with the past, which I think is a very important thing, not to lose history. That is to be in advance in some ways, but not to forget what's gone before.
Mm-hmm. We can see your art in public spaces, in Cleveland, in Philadelphia, in Miami, in many cities in Europe and the United States. Do you feel lucky in a way that you can make public sculpture, that one doesn't need to go inside a museum or a gallery to see your work? Is that the way you'd most like it to be?
Well, in 1978, when Kosch and I, after a brief period in Holland, moved back to America, we deliberately set out to put art outdoors and make it more accessible, because we didn't like the gallery system where the artwork gets lost and goes into a vault and is never seen again, and is seen, if at all, by very few people. So we wanted to create a work for more people, and a work that participated with the real world. So we set out to do this series of large-scale projects. In 1985, we had come to the point where we thought perhaps it would be interesting to go back to some work that was more personal and more, say, gallery-oriented, because we were really losing touch with that part of the art scene.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that when you go into public art, you definitely cut yourself off from the art scene, because it's a very specialized activity. And you find that it's mostly reported in architecture magazines or in the daily press. And art magazines kind of go in another direction completely. But with the performance in Venice, Italy, of the Cotello, the Corso del Cotello, which Kosha had stimulated, and which we did with the aid of many people in Italy, students and companies, the work went back to a smaller scale. And since then, we have been working inside of galleries as well as outside of galleries.
You live in Manhattan, in the Soho area.
That's right.
What do you see in the city that gives you the kind of excitement, the kind of delight, visual pleasure, irony, whatever that you hope your sculpture gives to other people? What do you see that gives you that feeling? That's either art or just happens to be there.
Well, in a city like New York, there's so many things, and there's so many moods, and there's so many different states of weather, and so many people. There's so much that it's very difficult to isolate anything. If Kosch and I concentrate on something, we finally manage to find some kind of a focus in a city for our thinking. In Des Moines, it was the umbrella. We have still not done anything for New York City, and it's a difficult city to do anything for, because there is really a lot here. I mean, the skyscrapers and the towers and the traffic and the many human beings. It's a little overwhelming, and you feel that perhaps the sculpture might get lost in all of it. And if you did do a sculpture, you couldn't summarize it somehow. It's just too big. There's another element about New York, and that is that it's in constant process. And one feels that that there's something inconsistent about a permanent work in the streets of New York. So I don't know. At one point, I had proposed a work that would be just a car on the subway, and it just would ride around underground, and it would just have a certain character of its own. And every time it would come into the station, there would be the monument. And some people might never see it at all, and some people might see it all too often, but it would always be in movement.
That's a lovely idea. I really like that.
Well, I think that New York is a place which makes you think about different solutions, which is one reason that it's nice to live here. It's a very tough city, but if you're in fortunate enough to be in a situation where you can observe it from a distance, then it's another matter.
Artist Klaus Oldenburg. Rizzoli has just published the book Klaus Oldenburg, Multiples in Retrospect, 1964 to 1990. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.